You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition today. We're glad to have you join us. Remind everybody that if you're listening live, you can still go back and pick up the archive by going to the link on our website to the radio show where we archive the last dozen or so shows that you can download. And one of the things I'm pleased about, I talk to people all the time about the downloads, and the downloads show it to be pretty popular. But I'm glad that people are doing that and get to enjoy the show even though they may not be able to listen live. Today I've got with me Paul Carey, who's president-elect of the Texas Society of Professional Surveyors. And I met Paul back in the fall at the Surveyor Conference in Houston for the Texas Society, and we had a conversation and got to talking about some of the things that he's been doing. And so I thought, well, that'd be a pretty cool thing. I bet our listeners would like to hear about that, because one of the things, Paul, that we always try to do is get a variety of issues and topics and activities that are going on so we can sort of keep the show as vibrant as possible, and people do like to hear what other people are doing. So welcome to the show.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you very much.
Glad to have you on. So maybe as a good starting point, you can inform our audience a little bit about you and what you're doing in Texas, and how you got interested in what we're going to talk about today.
All right. Well, I am a registered surveyor in Texas. I'm also a licensed state land surveyor. We have two licenses because Texas still has sovereign territory, and the second license is actually the elder of the two, and it entitles me to file paperwork in our general land office. I have been practicing for almost 30 years and have in the last 10 years pretty much gone to a one-horse show here. I do kind of a solo operation with the advent of great technology like GPS. I'm able to do a lot of work without having to hire a lot of staff, and I have always maintained the principle of seeing everything I've ever signed, and this makes that much more possible for me. I've enjoyed it quite a bit.
That's one thing that is of interest, and one thing that we all would like to think we do in any situation: go out, walk every boundary, be part of the collection process and discovering what's out there. And I think you're right. I think with the advent of new equipment, I think it does facilitate that more so than there was a period of time there when electronics came along and we started depending a lot on that and sending people out doing a lot of things. I think folks kind of lost that direct relationship in some cases to the property itself, and so it's always cool when you're able to do that.
Well, and I've learned over the years that the ability to recognize monumentation and recognize oddities is something that's not being taught. And young party chiefs and field crews are doing a pretty mechanical operation in a lot of situations without a whole lot of thought and analysis going on.
Right, yeah. I always recall an incident. I think I may have mentioned this on the show one time before. I was out walking a job with one of my folks years ago, and that one of the corners was an old car axle, and they hadn't been able to find it, and so we were just out trying to see what was out there, and I said, that thing's got to be around here somewhere, and walked over and kicked an old dead tree laying on the ground, and there it was.
So, that's right.
Nobody had taken the time to really look around enough.
A lot of young surveyors wouldn't know what an axle was.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's very
especially
true.
Especially if it was a buggy axle or something like
that. Yeah, I think this was an old car axle, but nevertheless, it was not something a lot of people would recognize these days, that's for sure.
Yeah, we see a lot of old sucker rods set for corners, and people don't realize what that is, and they see the notes that says sucker rod, and they have no idea what they're looking for.
Yeah, our audience is a little bit familiar with the licensed state surveyor designation. A couple of people have been on the show. We've talked that about. And of course, every time we do, I always mention my good friend Jerry Goodson, who was among that group.
Yes, sir. My friend as well. I miss him dearly. Yeah.
Yeah. We all do.
Jerry had a wonderful collection of odds and ends and collectible items, and I was unable to make the auction where they were trying to sell and raise some money for his widow. And the only thing I walked away with was an old plumb bob of his. The compasses all went for more money than I could afford.
So. Yeah, my understanding is that that did go very well. No question about it.
So we miss Jerry.
Yeah, we all do. Maybe a good way to start our conversation on some work you've been doing here is to, I know you have a website that people can go to. Maybe we could give them that link, and then we can start talking about the project.
There is an excellent map that was done as an illustration probably for one of the lawsuits that transpired in this case, and it is at the Texas General Land Office's website in their archives. And there is a link, I could read it, but I think the easier way to get there is just to Google the Texas GLO, and under what we do, you would click our collection and go to the Historics Map Index and look up map number 9503. And that's a beautiful map. I keep a copy of it in my office. I have it mounted. It's just fun to look at, and it has led me to keep digging into this. And even last week, I found new documents that I hadn't seen before.
Now, did this initiate because of some project you were doing, or did you have a curiosity about this particular map, or how did that occur?
It definitely came up as in the process of doing a survey. I had a five-acre tract. I live in Castroville, which is on the Medina River, which I found out was at once considered one of the boundaries between the U.S. and Mexico. And across the river on the outside of town was a five-acre tract. And when I got the order to make the survey, I did some research. And one of the things I do is I check with the land office to make sure the abstract number is correct. And in so doing, found that the land office had not issued an abstract number for this land yet, which generally indicates that it's sovereign territory. So I pulled the file. I could do that online as well. Found that there was no notation on the file for this having been patented or released by the state. Immediately got on the phone and called the chief surveyor there, and he verified that was the case. They considered that to be surveyed unsold Texas school land. All the public land has been dedicated to the school fund. And I thought that was very interesting. Contacted the title company, and they seemed unimpressed. They had been carrying it under the sister survey. This was one of two surveys that were done together in a block. And they had been carrying it under the abstract number of the sister survey for the last 30 or 40 years and seemed unconcerned about it. They'd insured it before, and they're going to continue to insure it. I think they issued title with the wrong abstract number on it. But I found this article, this document in that file that was a Senate resolution by the Texas Senate that was published in 1913 that listed all of these surveys that had been canceled. And I kind of got real curious as to why there would be a dozen or so surveys canceled. And it led me to what was called the John McMullen Grant. I'm still finding new things out about that grant every day. It was a piece of property that was initially deeded to the Native Indians of the Mission San Jose in 1766. And the Indians apparently never occupied it. The church, the Mission San Jose, never really did anything with it. And about 1833... Father Refugio de la Garza sold it for 330 pesos, bought it for 330 pesos from the Indians, and then sold it to John McMullen for $11,000. That was $1,000 per league. If this was an 11-league grant, the league is 5,000 square, or 5,000 varas square, which comes out to about 4,428 acres. So he had 11 of those. So this should have been roughly 48,000 acres. And what had been going on even during that time was there were settlers being placed there by the Mexican government and subsequently by the Texas government. And at one point, Henry Castro, for whom Castroville is named. He was a empresario under Spanish and Mexican reign of this area. He was bringing settlers in from Europe. His were coming in from Alsace, France. And Henry Castro had made arrangements to pay McMullen money for every settler that he brought in as compensation for the use of his land. So McMullen was exercising ownership rights over the land. He was showing that he owned it. He was a little more forgiving about the fact that there were other people already settled within the bounds of the grant, even when he bought it. And so he eventually sold this to a man named, it eventually became the property of a guy named Bainbridge Howard. And Bainbridge Howard, who lived in California at the time, decided that he wanted to uncloud his title. So he took it to court, first in the district courts here in Texas, and then eventually over the timeline we'd see here that he took it all the way through the federal court. And what piqued my interest was, if you look at this map that I gave you a reference to, the notation on there that it was addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I thought that was probably the most interesting thing I'd seen in the Texas boundary cases, having the U.S. Supreme Court get involved. Last time that happened, it was in Texas and Oklahoma. There's a quite an involved timeline and a whole lot of characters involved in this process. Names that people might recognize, like Samuel Maverick and Branch T. Masterson, along with John James, who was a very prolific surveyor in Texas. Probably credited, he is credited with surveying more land than any other human being. Let's see, who else? Charles de Montel, he was a Castroville resident. He was also what they called a land baron. Because when Texas was established in 1836, we had a lot of territory and not a whole lot of money. So Texas began to pay their bills with land scrip. So he got a piece of paper that was worth anywhere from 340 to 1,280 acres. And 320 to 1,280 acres. And a lot of people who did work here weren't really interested in settling. Some of them were on their way to California and other places. And so they would want to convert that to cash. And so you had guys like Sam Maverick and Branch Masterson, Charles de Montel, a guy named John Herndon, and Henry Custer, who would buy this script from their settlers or from the recipients at about 30 cents on the dollar, and then turn around, find some vacant land, survey it, get the paperwork filed with the land office, and have a marketable title to sell. And they would probably
sell. That might be a good spot to stop, Paul, for our first break. Let's go ahead and take that. We'll be right back.
All right.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back with Paul Carey today talking about an issue that he's been involved in on the McMillan grant. And before we get further into to the explanation of the project itself, as you were talking, a number of questions came up.
Sure.
That I had. One is, I don't know if you related to whether or not you are a native Texan or you came to Texas like a lot of other folks.
Well, yes, I was born actually in San Antonio. My mom was a registered nurse, so she got me half price, and my dad was a college professor. So,
oh, excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another question I had with the project itself that facilitated or got you into all of this research, was that a project that got started out of some controversy, or was it just a survey you were doing and you ran into this as you were doing research?
It was just a survey I was doing that sort of developed into controversy. It turns out
this
tract of land that wasn't patented was about 40 acres. There are six owners that still occupy it, and some of them have been there for three generations.
Oh, well.
So they were under the understanding it was their land. I took it upon myself to notify them what I had found, and I got no responses. I figured most of them figured I was just looking for some extra work. But really didn't develop into much other than finding out that this tract of land, even to date, has not been patented. These people are awarded the land by the state. The state is going to honor their commitment to award it to these people. At one point during this process, and I'll get into the court process as I understand it, it's a lot deeper than I'd intended it to be. But during this process, people were told that they didn't own land. They were you had settlers who had been on the land already a generation or two, who, because the Supreme Court in, let's see what the date was, 1861, initially started to hear the case and determined that the U.S. Supreme Court determined that the land grant to McMullen was a valid grant and that these people were trespassers. This was after the Texas courts had determined that McMullen did not receive a fee title, that he had only received the Indians had only received what amounted to a lease on the land, and that McMullen was basically cheated out of his money. But he made it back. The Supreme Court overturned that decision and decided that McMullen's title was good. And after they did that, they notified the Texas General Land Office to void all of those patents, give those people their certificates back, and have them relocate elsewhere so they would get the same acreage somewhere else. Some of them took them up on that. I keep imagining the clerk from the land office who was instructed to go down to South Texas and tell this man that his papers no good, get off my land, and see if he can get away alive.
And this was still in the 1800s, right?
Yes, this would have been, the first case was heard in 1849 in the local courts, which was shortly after statehood. Texas became a state in 1845. We fought the Mexican-American War in 1846, and it was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which was the end of the Mexican-American War, that as part of the treaty, the Texas, for instance, was instructed that they were to honor all of the Spanish and Mexican grants, and some people took that to include the McMullen grant, because some Spanish families had been evicted from their property after the Mexican Revolution, and then again some Mexican families were evicted after the Texas Revolution, and the choice to include those families back into statehood and the people had to, within a year, the residents had to become U.S. residents.
One of the things that we all have to deal with in surveying is dealing with differences in terminology and methodology as time has gone on, and that's going to be the case no matter where one operates. But it always seemed to me, and I'm sure this is not specific only to Texas, obviously, but in states where there was a strong Spanish influence and even Spanish ownership of the land, that has to have its own challenges in terms of being able to, first of all, understand the terminology and the methodology from there, and then how that applies to what you're doing now. That seems to me to be challenging.
Well, it certainly does not only include Texas, because part of the settlement in the Guadalupe Hidalgo Treaty was that Mexico ceded some of Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and Southern California to the United States. So there were Spanish settlements in all of those places already, Spanish and Mexican settlements. It was a huge amount of territory that changed hands at that point. And I think that all of those states were faced with that same situation where Spanish and Mexican settlers their land rights were honored by the United States and by Texas. So, that was an interesting development.
Yeah, I would think so. And I guess none of us were around at that point in time, of course. but like I said, the terminology and the methodology, I guess, it really doesn't change location of things specifically in terms of how boundary lines are established, I'm sure.
Right.
But just understanding what the various terminology means when translated, I guess, can become challenging.
Sure. Well, and what's interesting about this is that there is a deed that's referred to. This survey was retraced by John James, and by Charles de Montel. John James' records are in the General Land Office, and Charles de Montel's records are in the county office. And this was originally, as I said, supposed to be 11 leagues, and they, in the original field notes, gave it what they call a bounds description. It basically started at a hilltop, went to another hilltop, and went on a compass bearing to where a road crossed a river, and followed the road to where it crossed another river, and then just basically gave a compass bearing to the northwest to a point, and then back to the hilltop. And that was the original description. I haven't recovered it, but I've seen references to it. I'm trying to get to the Spanish archives in San Antonio and see if I can dig deep enough to find that original deed. But I have the deed from Father Refugio to John McMullen, and it's pretty rudimentary in that respect. But
I was going to say that raises another question. When you're doing that kind of work in that whole area there, you know, from where you guys are out to the West Coast and all those other areas you just mentioned, is the archiving of all that old information back from the Spanish rule era still available?
Some of it is. Some of the records, of course, the Mexican government was very interested in having these Mexican citizens retain their properties in the now in the United States. So they were willing to relinquish many of those records to the United States and to Texas to help those families retain those lands. So the Spanish archives in San Antonio in the Bexar County Courthouse there are pretty extensive. I've managed to get in there once or twice and found some really interesting stuff. When Medina County was established out of what was the Bexar District, which extended from about where San Antonio is all the way west and as far north as the north of the boundary of Wyoming, that was part of that Spanish secession of western states, and part of the Louisiana Purchase as well. All of that was Bexar District is what they called it. And so all of those records, everything that was generated in the Bexar District stayed in San Antonio because San Antonio was the seat of the Bexar District. So all of the district surveyors filed their records there. And they have two massive books there they don't have them indexed yet, but I managed to sit down and page through those books a couple of times to look for a particular description that is not in the land office because it was never patented under the original survey. And recently, actually, went to the Medina County Courthouse and went through the transcribed records that were provided to Medina County when it was established. It came out of the San Antonio records and found, probably a dozen resurveys of properties within the bounds of the McMullen grant are on the edges that were resurveyed to exclude that portion that entered the grant. These were never filed at the land office because the case was resolved otherwise. But so I've got a half a dozen surveys on the western boundary, or a dozen surveys on the western boundary, that I could actually trace back to locate the bounds of the original McMullen grant based on 1850s and 1860s resurveys.
So does that mean that in there's a possibility that if someone in one of the states other than Texas that fell within that Spanish jurisdiction were trying to trace back really old records, they would have to come to Texas to do that?
I don't think that much happened very far west from San Antonio.
Okay.
That the parts of that original Republic of Texas that extended up through Colorado into Wyoming didn't. There wasn't a whole lot of communication going on there. I think Texas was pretty happy to get rid of that.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking that could be quite an interesting situation if one were. In a position to have to do that.
You never know. I haven't seen anything that's outside of the current boundaries, but there might have been something. I would say that it would be rare, but it could be there. If I ever see one, I'll let you know.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see, that's for sure. By the way, when you were clicking off the list of names there earlier, when I was reviewing some of the information you sent me, and I ran across the John Herndon name.
Uh-huh.
I went and did a little Google search because I live in Fairfax County, Virginia, not in an incorporated town, but the closest town to me and my actual address is Herndon, Virginia.
Oh, really?
So,
okay.
Yeah, so I went to try to find out if maybe there was a connection, but I couldn't find one. It was a different person. So.
There are several of them out there, and I didn't find anything on this particular Mr. Herndon. I believe he was an attorney in San Antonio along with Samuel Maverick.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Maverick apparently were business partners to some degree. Maverick, of course, hit it big and did really well. Herndon ended up being bankrupt by the time all the court proceedings ended, and he kind of faded away. I haven't heard much of him since then.
Right. Yeah, as I said, the person that is the namesake for this town near where
yeah.
I live was an entirely different person. But having said that, with the way our country was developed, there's always possibilities of connections. I mean, you find that all across the United States from the East Coast to the West. So
John James was from Nova Scotia, and our current TSPS president is also from Nova Scotia, so he feels some
kind
of a personal affiliation to him. But
yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, we're about 10 seconds away from our next break, so before
okay.
we get too deeply into anything else, we'll come back here in a little bit. And I didn't want to get off track necessarily, but I did want to pick up on some of these other thoughts as we went through. So
absolutely.
Let's go do that break, and we'll come right back.
All right.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear?
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that Pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Schonstedt, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
This is the time of our show when we have our Parker Davis Quick Stakes Contest of the Week, and the way it works is I ask a question of the guest, and whoever emails to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com, the response from the guest will be the winner for the week. So, Paul, the question for today is, what do the initials GLO stand for?
Here it stands for General Land Office.
General Land Office, and that's obviously in Texas, but that's where we're talking about. So General Land Office is what we're looking for. Thanks for helping me with that.
No problem.
We want to get back on our basic topic. I do want you to answer one other quick question, though. Everybody who listens to the show wants to know how the guest got involved in surveying to begin with.
Kind of as I said earlier, it's sort of by accident. I was a geology student. Graduated from school with a bachelor's degree in geology about the same time everybody else came to back to South Texas to look for work in the oil field. So I took a surveying job. They pretty much hired me on as a party chief because I could do the math and understood the technology and the mechanics. And pretty quickly decided I wanted a license and haven't been able to quit. Thought about it a couple times.
Well, it is addictive. There's no question about that. I think any of us that have been in it for all these years understand how addictive it is.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Well, before I sidetracked you and started talking about other issues, we were talking about the, I don't know if case is the right word or project is the right word, the McMullen grant. So, yeah. Let's pick back up on that and start, maybe we can work our way through it.
Okay. Well, I talked about when McMullen got this deed and he passed it on to Bainbridge Howard, and Bainbridge Howard started through the court process to try to recover clear title, get the other deeds and titles off of his land. And I mentioned the fact that it went through the U.S. Supreme Court, but then it came back to the Texas courts. And what happened was the U.S. Supreme Court started hearing these cases, and about through the U.S. court system, the district courts, in 1861. Well, in 1861, something else very important started, and that was called the Civil War. And Texas seceded from the nation on February 1st. The court actually made their decision later that year. Mr. Herndon complied with the court's decision to, go and just vacate all of his property. Maverick appealed it. And at that point, the U.S. Court systems and government offices in Texas had closed. And so really nothing happened until about 1865. And in fact, the Texas government did not, actually the Civil War didn't end in Texas until almost 1866 when government offices reopened. And the Texas legislature acknowledged the treaty. And so essentially what happened was the Texas Supreme Court reheard the case starting in 1874, and by 1877 they had decided to follow one of Samuel Maverick's arguments in court, and that was that the U.S. Supreme Court had no jurisdiction in Texas during the Civil War because we were a combatant nation, and that's kind of an international standard. So basically the Texas Supreme Court threw out the U.S. Supreme Court decision, went back to their original decision in the first case that they came to, which was McMullen versus Hodge, which determined that McMullen had no title to the land, and they reinforced that. And so it really blew my mind that the Texas Supreme Court was ignoring and overturning a U.S. Supreme Court decision, and I had to do a little digging to figure out how that happened. So about during that time, during this period of 40 or 50 years, the General Land Office here had been instructed to cancel these grants and return the certificates. And it seems to me that over 4 years they would have gotten a lot done, but it only turned out that there were some 12 or 15 certificates returned. Some of those were for a league or two leagues of land. These are people with four to 10,000 acres that had to pick up stakes and go somewhere else. Many of them fought it and resisted and moved very slowly. I think the land office moved very slowly on it, knowing that this case was going back to court, and of course we're in the middle of a civil war. The Texas concurrent resolution, the Texas Senate resolution, instructed the land office to reinstate all of the previously displaced owners, which was impossible because some of them had settled elsewhere. Others had had other people come in and settle on the land that they had previously occupied. The area that got me involved in this was, it was a subdivision, actually. It's a farm lot subdivision on the other side of the river from the city of Castroville, and they created these 40-acre tracts. And those 40-acre tracts were being sold by the original grantor to individuals who wanted a small farm. And so in this process, many of those farmers, after having their grantor's title canceled, went back and got their own patents on these original tracts. And the sister tracts that I was surveying out of the day that I discovered this were, it was a little two-lot railroad block. The railroad companies in Texas were being enticed with land to build railroad here. They would, for every mile of track, survey 16 sections of land and keep every other section. They'd keep the first one, the third one, fifth one, and so on. The even section lands would go to the state. And so of this two-block survey that they made, Section 1 went to the railroad company, and they immediately sold their interest in it. Section 2 went to the state. Well, there was already somebody living on and farming that land when it was patented. And that individual, after this whole process went through the courts, he went back to the district court in the county here and basically went to the judge and said, is it mine or is it not mine? And the judge says, it's yours. He said, great, thanks, bye. And he never went through the process of getting it patented. And that case was actually included in one of the files at the land office. It was included in this file at the land office. The fact that he had gone to court and had a decision made that it was his property, he didn't feel like he needed to do anything else. And so this, you know, perpetuates today, where the title company is still carrying those landowners' titles and their insurance under the wrong abstract number.
Well, I'm sure that continues to cause problems.
Well, it as long as the title company is going to continue to insure them, that's all right. But if somebody else takes over this title industry in this town and decides that they need to straighten it up, then it's going to be a can of worms for sure. Samuel Maverick, his name shows up as I looked at old maps. I find his name all over the place, and on the final maps that the county, that the state uses to show the original patents within Medina County here, they put the name of the original grantee, the original awardee, the person whose name appeared on the certificate when the land was patented. But over time, they used to put the name of the patentee on those surveys, and you will see these names. You'll see Samuel Maverick on just tons of these tracks. You'll see Charles and Montel on tons of these tracks. And these two that I'm working with weren't included, and most of those farm lots aren't included. But I have to deal with those farm lots on a pretty regular basis, and the fact that you have different abstract numbers every time you cross one of those 40-acre lines, gets a little complicated, and you really like to keep track of where you are out there.
So when you were talking about working, these are ongoing projects, or did the issue come up from time to time when another project comes along?
Well, when the Senate told the General Land Office to reinstate all the previous owners. There were some tracts out there in these 40-acre lots that were part of the cancellation. Now, this owner in particular, it was Jane Calder was her name. When her original patent was canceled, she paid for and got a corrected survey on the portion that she was going to keep, which was a tenth of what she originally was granted. And when the Senate told the land office to reinstate those owners, those tracts that had not yet been repatented would have fallen back into her original title, but she had already accepted a correction. So those tracts were open for reapplication by new settlers.
Does right to that then come through the state of Texas? Is that the way it works?
Yes. Yeah, when her original patent was canceled, that land reverted back to sovereign territory, or initially to Mr. Howard, Bainbridge Howard, who had held title to it. He would have been the person who needed to then go to the land office and get the patent written for everything that was left. Because it was then overturned again and it all reverted back to the state, there were new applicants that had to come in and get clear title to that land from the state. What I am finding is that there were some mistakes and there were a few misunderstandings, let's call them, and there are still some voids out there, which we technically refer to as a vacancy, which is a surveyed unsold school land. We know where it is. We know how big it is. We've got a description of it, but it's still patented, or not patented. It's still sovereign territory. And I know of one or two of those in this area. And so, it does. It gets real complicated, especially when you get somebody who comes out and does a farm survey. They come out and they survey, 1,200 acres, and they're all over these little farm tracts with different patents on them, and they miss one of these vacancies. And I've got one surveyor that came out and did one of the farms up in that area, and I looked at his survey and said, oh my gosh, he is all over the place. In terms of where the original patent line thought, he was lost.
So having heard you say that, and I know we got to go to break here in a half a minute or so, but is it possible that some individual landowner actually ends up owning a property that incorporates more than one of one of these parcels that you were talking about?
The vacancies. Essentially those six owners that are on that one railroad block it's not a vacancy, it's surveyed unsold school land. But I know of another farmer north of them who has been farming a tract of land. He's third generation. It's been farmed by his family since day one. And when he had his survey done, the surveyor showed it to be part of one of the patents up there, and I can prove that it's not. He's missing 40 acres.
Yeah, maybe we can pick up on that when we come back from our last break.
Good deal.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back, everyone, to our final section today on the NSPS Radio Hour. And glad to have Paul Carey with us. And we've been talking about a project, a situation. I'm not sure exactly how this all rolls out because it seems to be an ongoing thing. One question I had real quickly was, in getting to resolution for all of these properties, is that something that's specific to the licensed state land surveyor or registered professional surveyors who are not licensed state land surveyors allowed to do that?
Oh, they're certainly allowed to research and identify these. The only change that happens when you become a licensed state land surveyor is that you can present your results to the land office and hope that they'll file them. But no, I've had one of my mentors has often said that the licensed state land surveyor shouldn't know anything more than what the, or should, she says the other way around, the registered professional surveyor should know just about everything the licensed state land surveyor knows. And I know a number of them who are highly qualified and experienced in this area, and I would trust with this kind of a project any day.
So I guess that being said, though, just like in any other situation where we're all relatively equal, I can see how something as complicated as all this can cause differences of opinion about the way things fall out.
That's a phrase I use all the time when I'm talking about surveyors. I do a little bit of teaching here, and one of my pet phrases is a survey is an opinion, and if you want a better opinion, get another surveyor. So I agree with you that it does leave a lot of room for opinion. My thinking is that the guy who can back up his opinion is the guy who I'm going to listen to, so.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, on the break, you had mentioned another map that people might be able to see.
When I was talking about these 40-acre tracts, our general land office will prepare what they call a working sketch, which is basically a graphic summary of a group of original field notes from these patent files. And there's a working sketch. It's on counter number 70934. So if you want to look up that map, what that is a working sketch of all those 40-acre tracts, or some of them, not all of them, out of the Jane Calder survey that's across the river from the city of Castroville. And it's a really interesting map, and I said to you that even on that map, I found that the technician who was summarizing it made a mistake and included a part of one of the surveyed unsold school lands under one of the patents. So there's even an error on this map where people just misunderstood what they were reading. And I presented that to the land office, but I haven't seen them correct this map yet, so I don't think they're worried about it. They'll wait till I file the correction, and they'll just put it in the file.
Yeah. Yeah, you pointed out one really important thing there I think it's worth following up on a little bit, and when you made the statement that a survey is an opinion, and that's very true. I mean, we all have our ways of making determinations, and one of the critical elements I've always found is that, yeah, we do have different opinions, and we respect each other in terms of the fact that we do have differing opinions, and hopefully we can have conversations about that from a factual perspective, or maybe factual isn't the right word, but from a research perspective and the amount of effort that's gone into making a decision, but
sure,
still maintain our respect all the way through.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, I try to be respectful of anybody I have an argument with. I may not agree with them, but I won't show them any disrespect.
Yeah. I find, for the most part, that's true among all of us as surveyors. I think you find that more to be the case more often than not in those situations. Matter of fact, you and I were talking on the break about this mock trial I'm going to be involved in at the Virginia Surveyors Conference, and you had been involved in one of Gary Kent's also, and in reading the script for that thing, that thing just kept coming back in my mind over and over and over again. You know, as we we go out and do our work, and we do the most diligent work we can, and we can still come up with different interpretations of what's out there. So you're right.
Yeah,
that respect is very, very true.
We are human, and human nature does have a tendency to get involved.
Yep, that it does. Now, you mentioned something about a course you've been developing.
Well, I have been trying to develop this project into a course for several years, and every time I get close, I dig deeper and find more stuff. But what I have found is that these I mentioned earlier that there were some surveys prepared to file for adjusted or corrected boundaries to eliminate that portion of any of these patents that crossed into the grant. So I've got a dozen or so of these surveys that were rewritten by John James and another county surveyor at the time to correct the boundaries of these surveys. And what these individuals were looking at is they would lose some territory to the McMullen grant, but they would get a certificate for some more land. And they're going to get that land already paid for. I mean, all they have to do is figure out where they want it and get some more land elsewhere. There are other some of these that were filed at the land office. There's probably another 8 or 10 of them that were filed as corrected boundaries, and then somebody would come in later after the courts were through with this, and they applied for the remnants. Now, those boundary lines are official patent boundary lines. Some of them are still evident on the ground. Because this description, the original description, had course and distance. Actually, John James was the first one to actually put course and distance on the description, but he did it from a retracement. And because two of the corners are hilltops, natural monuments, and I've been on both of those hilltops. One of them now has a bunch of radio towers on it, and the corner of the grant, because it became a line demarking the boundary of the original patents, has actually been occupied by various owners and now is occupied by a subdivision on one side. So that line is perpetuated on the ground. It can be recovered, theoretically. We think it's right. Over the years, people thought they knew where it was, and that's where they put the boundaries of the modern development. Well, that line is occupied in both directions. That's the rooftop shape that occupies the top of the grant. From that rooftop, State Highway occupies the line both east and west. So recovery of right-of-way maps would allow me to try to reproduce the location of that line. And then to the eastern end at the northeast corner, where you're back on a hilltop, I have been there, and there is a USGS reference mark on that hilltop. I don't know if it's where the monument was, but it's on the hilltop. I assume it's close. There's a massive pile of rocks next to it. I don't know if that's the mound that was created in the 1860s. But the hilltop is recoverable, and that is right outside of Loop 1604 in San Antonio, the outer loop. The interesting thing about this, and one interesting thing about this perimeter is that when you run it out by its courses and distances, you end up with not 47,000 acres, but closer to 107,000 acres. It's about 55 miles of perimeter, which is actually the exact same distance as Loop 410 in San Antonio, the inner loop, and incorporates about the same area. So this was a massive piece of land. These people did not think small. But from the Spanish on, when the Spanish granted somebody something and they wanted to honor that person, they gave them, 10 or 15 leagues of land, and that was just a huge amount of land. It's hard to conceive of it. So one of the things I wanted to do is take a group of surveyors and present them with this problem and let them talk about it and try to figure out what they would do, and then start presenting them with some of the evidence that I found. Some of these lines, some of the John James surveys or survey notes recovered corners of some other original surveys. Those corners can be recovered today. There are, as I said, highway right-of-way maps that show the original lines. Those surveys can be recovered today. We had natural monuments that were crossed. We had calls for roads that crossed creeks. Well, I know where the creek is. I've been within a couple hundred feet of one of them, but I didn't have permission to go there any farther. But if we can get to those creek crossings and find any evidence of there being an old road there, we could recover those corners today. Unfortunately, much of the old original roadway that they followed is both through an irrigated farm development called the, both on one side of the county line, it's called the San Antonio Trust irrigated farm development. The other one, it's called the San Antonio Irrigated Farms. And that land has pretty much been wiped clean. I mean, it's cultivated fields and farm lots, and so you're not going to find much evidence of that old road there. But down in those creek crossings, we might find them. In some of the original surveys that have been modified to accommodate the boundaries of the McMullen Grant, we can find those. And some of those are actually occupied by roads along that route. And then on the western side, the General Land Office only has one survey that was modified on the western boundary, but I found just last week about a dozen more. And then on the north line, it calls John James Recovered on the far west corner. John James Recovered one of the original survey corners and tied it to his corner of the grant. And I know where that one is. I've surveyed next to it. I've been there, and I can get back if I need to. So I think it would be fun to either hand these surveyors, these students, all this data and have them go through it, or a combination, take them out and have them go look at some of this stuff. So you see, realize that you can recreate one of these ancient boundaries from evidence that's on the ground today. And we have a couple courses that we offer through the association and the volunteers of a number of rather prominent surveyors in our state that offer our surveyors 16 hours of continuing education credit on a Thursday afternoon through Saturday morning. And I'm considering doing one of those here. There is in Castroville, which is an 1820s settlement, there is an old hotel, used to be a wagon stop, that still rents rooms. It's run by the Texas Historical Commission now. But we can put 25 people up in that building if they don't mind sleeping in pairs in a bunkhouse, or they can stay at the hotel at the top of the hill. But one way or the other, we could bring out 20 to 30 surveyors, have them look at this data, develop a plan, give them the data, have them go through and see what the process would be to try to recover an ancient boundary like this. And I've always enjoyed that part of my work. I probably spend way too much time doing stuff like that, not getting stuff out the door. But obviously, I've been working on this for years, and nobody's paying me to do this.
That's certainly an intriguing thought, and we're 30 seconds away from being over with the show. I want to thank you for being with me, and this concept of what you've laid out here for maybe using this as a course sounds really intriguing. Hopefully some people will pick up on that, and I really do appreciate you being here. This has been a fantastic conversation and certainly enlightening to me, and I'm sure to our listeners as well, so I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I had fun.
Thanks, and looking forward to seeing you again sometime soon.
Good deal. I look forward to it myself.
Take care, Paul.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.